Go.
Hello, and welcome to our program, National Geographic, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I'm Dave Stokes.
And I'm Karen Stokes.
And during the next half hour, we will be reading articles from National Geographic here on OWL Radio. Our first item is regards Anne Boleyn. When Anne Boleyn was executed in 1536, her prized Book of Hours went missing for centuries. Now we know who helped keep it safe. Anne Boleyn, King Henry VIII's second queen, is often portrayed as a seductress and ultimately the woman responsible for changing the face of religion in England. Boleyn is now recognized as a fiercely intelligent and pious figure dedicated to education and religious reform. But after her arrest and execution on questionable charges of adultery and incest in May 1536, Henry VIII was determined to erase her. Her royal emblems were removed from palace halls, her sparkling jewels tucked away in dark coffers, and her precious books disappeared from the annals of time. But one of Anne Boleyn's possessions, her Book of Hours, reappeared. The stunning prayer book printed around 1527 with devotional texts designed to be read throughout the day features hand-painted woodcuts as well as a rare example of the Queen's own writing. In the margins of one of the beautifully decorated pages, she penned a rhyming couplet followed by her signature. Quote, "Remember me when you do pray, that hope doth lead from day to day." Signed, Anne Boleyn. The book vanished after Boleyn's execution, then resurfaced in the early 20th century when American millionaire William Waldorf Astor bought her Hever Castle, Boleyn's childhood home, in the English countryside. The journey of the disgraced queen's devotional book remained a mystery, however, until new research revealed previously unknown signatures on its pages, which helped trace part of its path through history. The book's whereabouts in the 360-odd years between Boleyn's death and its reemergence remained puzzling until 2020. That's when Kate McCaffrey, then a graduate student at the University of Kent, working on her master's thesis about the Queen's Book of Hours, found something unexpected in the margins. Quote, "I noticed what appeared to be smudges to the naked eye," recalls McCaffrey, an assistant curator at Hever Castle since 2021. Intrigued, she borrowed an industrial-strength ultraviolet light and set it up on the castle's darkest room. This type of light is often used to examine historical documents because ink absorbs the ultraviolet wavelength, causing it to appear darker against the page when exposed. She says, "The words just came through. It was incredible to see them underneath the light. They were completely illuminated," close quote, the curator recalls. McCaffrey's theory is that the invisible words were erased during the late Victorian era when it was popular to clean unnecessary marginalia from books or manuscripts. But thanks to her detective work, the erased words turned out to be the key that unlocked the tale of the book's secret escape from likely destruction at the royal court to safety in the hands of a dedicated group of Boleyn's supporters. Various pages throughout the text reveal the names and notations of a string of Kentish women, including Elizabeth Shirley, Philippa Gage, and Mary West, who banded together to safeguard Boleyn's treasured Book of Hours and to keep her memory alive. While it's not clear who among them was the first to receive the book, Boleyn expert Natalie Groninger suggests it was given to Elizabeth Hill by the Queen. Hill grew up near Hever Castle, and her husband Richard was sergeant of the King's cellar at Henry's court. There are records of the couple playing cards with the king, and a possible friendship with Hill might have prompted Boleyn to pass on her prayer book before her execution. This extended Kentish family kept the book safe following Anne's demise, which was an incredibly brave and bold act, considering it could have been treasonous, said Groninger, author of The Final Year of Anne Boleyn. The Book of Hours was handed among mothers, daughters, sisters, and nieces until the late 1500s, when the final name appears in its margins. The fact that the women have kept it safely is a really beautiful story of solidarity, community, and bravery, says McCaffrey. The book, now on display at Hever Castle, is a touchstone of the enigma that was Boleyn. Historian Owen Emerson points out that her DNA is on the pages she touched and kissed during her daily devotions. This was a really beloved possession of hers, says Emerson. Because of what happened to Anne Boleyn, we don't have a vast amount of information in her words. But the physical remains of her use of the book and the construction of that beautiful little couplet have her identity in them. Next. While Boleyn's Book of Hours found its way home, the research into its intriguing mystery is not over. McCaffrey continues to chart the book's provenance through the centuries to find out more about its furtive course and its owner, who has engendered fascination for more than 500 years.
Next, did you enjoy the cherry blossom's early peak bloom? It was a warning sign. A 1,200-year record of cherry blossoms shows our current climate is historically unprecedented. First, the green bud appears, sprouting. Hello, and welcome to our program, National Geographic, brought to you by OWL Radio and Low Vision Resource Center. I am Karen Stokes.
And I'm Dave Stokes.
And during the next half hour, we will be reading articles from National Geographic here on OWL Radio.
Our first item is called Brisk Business and Activism Collide at This Texas Horse Auction. At one of the largest sales in the country, seasoned traders and rescuers face off each month over the fate of hundreds of horses. Oh, boy. Bowie, Texas. A black bull charges out of the chute and two riders give chase. The cowboy in front lassoes the neck at a full gallop, slowing the bull just enough for rodeo heeler Whitney Monroe to maneuver her buckskin gelding into position and snare one of the bull's hind legs with her rope, and then release it with a snap of her wrist. Dazzling as the riders are, the trained eyes of would-be buyers watching from the stands this July day are on the horses, tracking their agility, speed, and instinct. On her next turn in the outdoor arena, Monroe, 33, a former rodeo queen who jokes that she was probably conceived on a horse, guides her mount between a triangle of barrels, whipping around the rims and bolting forward with a blend of finesse and raw power. She hopes the show will help fetch a high price when the bidding begins. Held the first weekend of every month at the sprawling barn complex next to about an hour's drive northwest of Dallas, the Bowie, Texas livestock sale has grown into one of the largest auctions of its kind in the United States, drawing a diverse array of American quarter horses and horse people. Swaggering ranchers and young rodeo stars, wide-eyed first-timers and hawkish traders who buy animals by the dozens. For most in attendance, the event is a vibrant, family-friendly ritual at the nexus of cowboy culture and capitalism. What makes this sale so unique is the diversity of customers, says Joel White, a veteran auctioneer who sold horses in more than 35 states. quote, some people come and pay $30,000 or $40,000 for a horse, and we'll sell lots of them for less than $1,000. So we have it all here, he says. The management, he adds, has done a phenomenal job of building this sale up from nothing. For all the pageantry and fancy catalog horses on offer, the Bowie Action is also a clearinghouse for animals at the bottom rung of the livestock business. Hundreds of horses and donkeys that pass through its gates each month will end up being processed in Mexican slaughterhouses. To animal rights activists, the auction is nothing more than a backdoor to the cruel and seldom seen underbelly of the international horse trade. It's a pit of despair, says Talia Fisher, 38, director of All Seated in a Barn, a nonprofit in Bakersfield, California, who travels to Bowie each month to rescue horses and donkeys. These animals are just objects in a system that cares only about profit, she says. The auction house was a run-down operation when Michael O'Dwyer, a farmer from Tipperary, Ireland, with 5 decades of experience working with cattle and horses, bought it in 2015. His family has revived the business with an expanded barn, glossy catalog, and brisk online sales, along with an unexpected boost from the COVID-19 pandemic. In Texas, horses are classified as livestock, not pets, because livestock was deemed critical to the food supply in the state, and other states placed more stringent restrictions on public gatherings. The Bowie auction was the only major auction in the country that remained open at the height of the pandemic. With public spaces closed, demand for recreational horses surged. Horses flooded in from as far as Florida and Pennsylvania, and the volume of sales doubled from 250 to more than 600 in a single day, compelling the O'Dwyers to make it a 2-day auction. The pandemic, this quotes, boosted our horse economy to the height it's been in 50 or 60 years, unquote, says David O'Dwyer, the sales manager. Quote, it's been extremely high, he says. Saturdays are for high-dollar performance horses, ranch horses with a nose for herding cattle, barrel racers raring to set new records, trusty mares for long trail rides or training children. Sundays feature the open sale, where hundreds of horses and donkeys, often in poor condition, are sold as is in a rapid-fire parade. Many of these animals are picked up for cents on the pound by kill buyers who ship them to Mexico for slaughter. In the U.S., it's illegal to sell horses for human consumption, but not against the law to eat horse meat. Although most revenue at Bowie comes from consignment sales, says O'Dwyer, he ships animals to meat processors in Mexico every week. As many as 3 trailers, each transporting 30 to 40 horses or donkeys that are worn out and nobody wants, he says, adding that it's more humane to put them down than to leave them to neglectful owners. An astute businessman, he manages to accommodate both the seasoned traders who do the bulk of buying and the rescuers trying to thwart them. Here's a story about a mare named Moonshine. At noon on Saturday, the selling begins, and a team of 3 auctioneers take turns in the public microphone to keep the pace. White, whose waxed mustache flares like a pair of longhorns, settles into an easy rhythm and leavens his folksy chat with humor. He says, if you want to raise a good kid, get him a good horse. They might become a thug on, or they might become a thug on the corner, close quote. And frank observations about a horse potential. Down in the ring below, riders shuttle the horses back and forth, flanked by a pair of spotters who relay signals from bidders in the stands in a fluid, time-worn choreography. Lot number 30, a 9-year-old black mare named Moonshine sells for $8,500, $1,000 above the minimum asking price. But it's a bittersweet moment for owner Kim Eisen, 52, who raised and barrel raced her competitively. She says her father sold his land and the family needed to downsize their herd because of higher feed costs linked to the ongoing drought. In a booth outside, in-house photographers take a souvenir portrait of Eisen and the mare. Out in the sun-blasted parking lot, 9-year-old rodeo phenom Cutter Farrington takes a break from showing his father's horses to practice his roping on a plastic bull. "I've been roping since I was 3, so I'm real good," he says. A lean, older cowboy walks up to teach him a trick, after which the youngster, ranked number two in the world for his age group, challenges him to a contest. Cowboy wins, but Farrington has a good excuse. His right arm's in a cast after a bull bucked him off 2 weeks ago. Well, yeah, that would handicap you. Back on the auction floor, Monroe puts her buckskin gelding through a final flourish to boost the sale price. She back walks, spins, and stops on a dime. The horse ends up for selling at $4,200. Later in the afternoon, her second catalog horse, a sorrel mare, falls well short of her asking price of $4,000. Monroe shakes her head, no sale. "I just couldn't let her go for that," she says, walking back through her to her trailer. "But we'll be back here soon enough." The Sunday Rush. On Sunday morning, Escher and volunteer Hillary Novak are perched on the edge of their seats on the top row of the sale barn. Their list has grown from 20 to 28 animals, including a must-have blue roan that was stolen from a holding pen at a previous auction. A familiar cast of traders and kill buyers who ship directly to Mexico are filing into the barn. Fisher points out a couple of them whom she says would like to bid up the price of a horse if they just know that she wants it, just to spite her. With hundreds of animals to sell, the auction runs at a breathless speed. Horses and donkeys of all sizes, ages, and conditions are sent onto the floor, snapped up in a flash, and whisked out the door. Fisher goes on a bidding streak, buying 3 horses in quick succession, while Novak live streams on Instagram and tracks the multiplying donations. For every horse they rescue, the auction house and the traders buy many more for slaughter. Charlie Carter, a gruff kill pen owner from Stroud, Oklahoma, boasts that for years he was the top horse buyer in the country, shipping hundreds of animals to meat processors every week until the last U.S. plant was shut down in 2007. These days, he rounds up bottom-tier horses and tries to give them a second chance by reselling them online. "Anything that rides that we can do something with, we will try to do it," he says. "But the rest got to go somewhere," referring to the slaughterhouse. Derek Moody, a 37-year-old African-American trader from Hearne, Texas, is blood about the lure of fast money. 2 years ago, he bought his first horse for $400, sold it the next day for $1,200. Quote, "After that, I was hooked," Moody smiles. "Now I dream of horses." He and his twin brother, Eric, travel to 8 auctions around the Southwest each month and earn a steady living, flipping an average of 100 to 150 horses. Moody grew up riding horses and competing in rodeo events where grit and skill earned respect. A stream of acquaintances walk up to swap news and crack jokes. Everybody here is nice, polite, and treats you the same, he says, leaning against a horse pen, hands framing one of his silver champion buckles. That sentiment is shared by Jesus Chuy Mendez, a Mexican-American vaquero from El Paso, Texas. Mendez runs a cattle ranch near the border, spends his time on both sides trading horses with his 8-year-old son, Jesus Jr., in tow. Father and son duo bought four seasoned ranch horses to Bowie, and they take turns putting them through their paces on the auction floor in a whirling blur of matching indigo denim. The recovered blue roan Fisher has her sights on finally comes up for sale. She insists she'll pay whatever it takes to bring him home and has enlisted a proxy buyer to keep rival traders from clocking her interest. A bidding war breaks out that sends the price climbing $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 until a miscue between Fisher and her proxy results in the horse's sale to another bidder for $7,500. The error has her seething under the brim of her ball cap, but Fisher is relentless. After repeated phone calls, the buyer agrees to sell her the horse. By the time the action closes at 5 p.m., she's bought nearly every one of the 28 horses and donkeys on her list and raised $68,000 on social media to help from B-list, with help from B-list celebrities, enough to cover all her costs. Now begins the laborious work of finding homes for the animals. Some of the roughly 250 in Fisher's Care network. I wish I could stop all of them from being shipped to slaughter, but what else is there, she says, lamenting the lack of rescue sources and the burden this place places on small-time activists faced with a deluge of horses in need. The end.
Next, Fashion's Desert Graveyard. The Atacama Desert in northern Chile stretches from the Pacific to the Andes across a barren expanse of red-orange rock canyons and peaks. As one of the driest deserts on Earth, it's a bucket-list destination for stargazing tourists who come for some of the clearest views of the night sky. With its arid, rocky landscape so closely resembling Mars, the desert has even attracted the attention of NASA, which has tested rovers there. But the Atacama has also attained a less wondrous distinction as one of the world's fast-growing dumps of discarded clothes, thanks to the rapid mass production of inexpensive attire known as fast fashion. The phenomenon has created so much waste that the UN calls it an environmental and social emergency. The challenge is turning off that tap. The numbers tell the tale. Between 2000 and 2014, clothing production doubled and consumers began buying 60% more clothes and wearing them for half as long as they once did. Three-fifths of all clothing is estimated to end up in landfills or incinerators within a year of production. That can translate to a truckload of used clothing dumped or burned every second. Most of the facilities are in South Asia or Africa, where the nations receiving those loads cannot handle the amount. The landfill near Accra, Ghana's capital, that is said to be 60% clothes and 65 feet high, has gained international notoriety as a symbol of the crisis. The scene in northern Chile has been dubbed in one online video the Great Fashion Garbage Patch, a terrestrial variation of the better-known Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Colossal piles of discarded clothes with labels from all over the world stretch as far as the eye can see on the outskirts of Alto Hospicio, a hard-scrabbled city of 120,000 residents. In one ravine, a pile of jeans and suit jackets bleached by the harsh sun rises above a mound of fake fur coats and dress shirts, some still bearing price tags. Bottles, bags, and other trash are mixed in. As images of the clothing heap spread on the internet, many Chileans express surprise. I was shocked to think that we were becoming the textile dump for developed countries, says Franklin Zepeda, a director of a company that focuses on circular economic practices. but the story of how the South American nation came to be a repository for the world's apparel rejects has as much to do with globalization and trade as it does with fleeting style trends. At first glance, it might seem that an isolated desert nearly 1,000 miles from Chile's population centers would be an unlikely destination for fast fashion's discards. But the country is also home to one of South America's largest duty-free ports, located in the coastal city of Iquique, on the Atacama's western edge. Millions of tons of clothes arrive annually from Europe, Asia, and the Americas. Last year's tally was 46 million tons, according to Chilean customs statistics. Duty-free ports encourage economic activity as goods are imported and often re-exported without the usual taxes and fees. The duty-free port was established in Iquique in 1975 to help generate jobs and improve ailing local economy. Chile became one of the world's largest importers of used clothes, which transformed Iquique. As fast fashion exploded, so did imports. The Zona Franca, free zone, was a true revolution for the city's residents, says Bernardo Guerrero, a sociologist at Fundación Creer, an organization that studies Iquique's history and culture. They suddenly had access to things they could never have imagined, like their own car. Apparel began washing in and out of Iquique like waves of global fashion change. Guerrero recalls a time in 1990s when almost everybody in the city wore the same style of puffer jacket. After large shipments of them arrived, it was a sign of what was to come. About 2,000 businesses of all types now operate in the duty-free zone. More than half are foreign. Hand-painted brand logos adorn warehouse doorways and stacks of used cars, another major import, tower over the narrow streets. The free zone has also developed into a sorting depot for textile waste. In essence, we are just recycling the world's clothes, says Mehmet Yildiz, who arrived in Chile from his native Turkey 2 decades ago and operates a clothing import business named Dilara. Yildiz brings in clothes from the United States and Europe, most of them from thrift stores such as Goodwill. Once the garments reach Iquique, workers separate them into 4 categories, ranging from premium to poor quality. Yildiz then exports the best to the Dominican Republic, Panama, Asia, Africa, and even back to the U.S. for resale. Clothing that the importers don't want ends up in the hands of truck drivers who ferry it a few miles to the dump outside Alto Hospicio, where it goes through another cycle of sorting and resale in small shops and street markets or at La Quebrandilla, a huge open-air market. There, a roaring used clothes trade continues on a half-mile-long strip of some 7,000 stalls. A recent visit turned up a faded T-shirt commemorating the 2001 U.S. Open Golf Tournament, a jacket emblazoned with logo of a Texas police force, and a wool hat with a badge of a California university among a sea of other cast-offs. Clothing that doesn't sell at the market is destined for the desert, and much of it is made from synthetic materials that won't biodegrade. Scavengers salvage what goods they can. On a cool afternoon, a woman named Genesis rummaged through a pile of formal clothes, nurses' uniforms, underwears, and Crocs, taking fleeces and blankets for the cold nights and earmarking the better garments to sell at La Quebradilla, where they may fetch a handful of coins. "Everything is useful to me," she said brightly, laughing, as she imagined herself in a brand-new summer dress printed with strawberries. "We're lucky to have found this." As helpful as resale markets might have been in the earlier era, they've been overwhelmed by the sheer scale of the mounting discards. New efforts, large and small, are underway to deal with the clothing waste, and attention to the mess in the desert may inspire additional projects. In 2018, Franklin Zepeda founded a startup that manufactures building insulation panels. Whoops, sorry about this, a few pages more. From textile waste. I'm motivated by the idea that there was a vast quantity of waste that could perfectly be transformed into raw materials to make new products, reducing the amount of clothes in our desert, he says. Another startup, Ecositex, based in Santiago, makes yarn from discarded clothes. Our mission is to eliminate textile waste from Chile, says Rosario Hevia. Ecositex owner, it made me so angry that there wasn't a solution, so I've thrown myself into solving it. Meanwhile, in Iquique, the clothing importer Dilara plans to open a recycling plant this year to make fillings for couch cushions from used clothes. These are small but critical steps. The most promising solution, one that can handle the problem scale, lies in the hands of the Chilean government. The World Bank forecasts 3.4 million tons of garbage will be created every year by 2050. As it piles up, many countries are requiring manufacturers to take responsibility for their products at the end of those products' lives. Policies known as extended producer responsibility have been adopted in India, Australia, Japan, Canada, and some U.S. states. In 2016, Chile passed a version into law calling it extended liability of the producer, or Ley REP for short. The law makes producers and importers accountable for six categories of waste: lubricant oils, electronics, batteries, small batteries, containers and packaging, and tires. Initially, textiles were not listed. Tomás Saig, who heads the Chilean Environmental Ministry's Circular Economy Office, says a team is working to add three more product types to the Ley REP, including textiles. The most important thing is to turn off the tap, so to speak, so that these clothes don't keep ending up in the desert. Converting Chile from a junkyard into a recycling hub would be a dream. In the meantime, must-have trends blink in and out of fashion, online sales keep churning, and mountains of forgotten clothes continue to grow amid the red sands of the Atacama Desert.
And now, here's what makes the Drake Passage one of the most dangerous places on Earth. They were six young voyagers rowing against the wind, against waves studded with shards of ice. It was, perhaps, the hardest way to get to Antarctica. In December of 2019, explorer Fien Paul led a team of athletes on an extraordinary expedition to row from South America to the icebound continent. To do it, they had to travel 600 miles across one of the most treacherous bodies of water in the world, the Drake Passage. Quote, cold and wet, unquote, says Paul, describing what it's like. It's dirty. The short waves that struck in quick succession were the worst. They hit you like walls. Deadly storms blow through this ferocious spot where the Pacific, Atlantic, and Southern Oceans meet. On maps, the spindly arms of Cape Horn and the Antarctic Peninsula reach out to grasp one another, separated only by the Drake Passage, which is named after Sir Francis Drake, a 16th century English explorer who had also been involved in the slave trade. Some prefer to call it Mar de Hoyques, in reference to Spanish sailor Francisco de Hoyques, who may have reached this part of the world 50 years before Drake. Most people have never seen the Drake Passage. They might, however, have seen jaw-dropping videos on TikTok or other social media platforms filmed by travelers on ship battered by towering waves. And yet, tumultuous waves aren't the only phenomenon that the region is known for. It's a bad place. The roaring winds and storms, the main reason why Drake Passage is so beset by storms is because the Southern Ocean, which encircles the frozen continent of Antarctica, is unbroken by land, meaning that mighty winds can rush around the globe unimpeded. We've just been through a large storm, actually, in the last 24 hours, says Karen Haywood, a physical oceanographer at the University of East Anglia. She is a member of a research team aboard the RSS David R. Attenborough, which, at the time of writing, was sailing southeast through the Drake Passage to the Weddell Sea on the eastern side of the Antarctic Peninsula. It's always interesting when you go to dinner and they put sticky mats on all the tables to make sure your plates and things don't slide around, said Haywood. She and her colleagues aim to study processes in the Weddell Sea that absorb carbon from the atmosphere and lock it into the ocean. Drake Passage itself is a melting pot, says Haywood, where extreme ocean currents take carbon, including that deposited by plankton, down into the depths where it could be stored for centuries. Strong currents in the passage also transport material from the Pacific thousands of miles away to the North Atlantic. This turbulent body of water has another function. It keeps Antarctica cold, says Alberto Naviera Garabato, a physical oceanographer at the University of Southampton. Without a land bridge to South America, it is much harder for warm air to make it to the globe's most southern reaches. Climate models suggest that when the Drake Passage opens tens of millions of years ago, no one is quite sure exactly when, it contributed massively to the cooling of Antarctica. You can feel the chilling effect of the Drake Passage when you cross it on a ship, says Garabato. Suddenly you're in this icy world, he explains. It happens just like that. You can see the transitioning happening in only hours. And we're going to have to leave it there. An interesting article.
You have been listening to National Geographic on OWL Radio. You can listen to OWL Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Karen Stokes.
And I'm Dave Stokes.
Saying goodbye from OWL Radio. Take care now.